This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Blessing Adiroba, and yes, what's coming up for you in this edition of Focus on Africa? Botswana and the mining giant De Beers have struck a deal to increase the country's stake in diamond production. We'll be asking how it will benefit ordinary people.
Botswana, unfortunately, you know, it's got a very good reputation among African economies, but it still struggles with massive issues of corruption. A lot of the time, business will go to state-owned companies rather than private companies. And unfortunately, that stifles job creation.
And hopping on one leg while trying to gain territory is an old Nigerian game that is trying to gain new fans. But how interesting is it to watch?
To be honest with you, watching a Langa match, it's as interesting as watching a Champions League game because there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of intensity, there's a lot of passion and resilience that you see from these players, and it's a very interesting sport.
It's Wednesday, the 5th of February. First, we go to Uganda. In 2005, Uganda set up military courts under the Uganda People's Defense Forces, UFDP Act, to try people involved in offenses related to carrying weapons or belonging to a militia. These courts have long been controversial because they subjected civilians to military justice. What's more, the trials were not just subject to civilian oversight. Critics say it was used to punish legitimate political dissent. In a near unanimous vote, seven judges ruled against the practice. But President Yoweri Museveni is not happy with this ruling. A military man himself, he says the tribunals helped to protect ordinary people from armed criminals. Let's hear why the constitutional lawyer, Tegule Gawaya, welcomes the ruling by the judges of the Supreme Court.
The 2005 law is what brought into play the offensive section that provided for persons subject to military law. And that included civilians. If, one, you were complicit in an offense with a military officer, or number two, you were found in possession of materials, anything like guns, military hardware, military boots, military clothing, then you are deemed to be subject to military law, even if you're not a militant or a military officer in the first place. So from 2005, it has been disaster.
Why wasn't the ruling done sooner?
The whole thing was that we have been complaining for a long time, but people must understand that Uganda is not a considered democracy anymore as it should have been or as it used to be at one point, because after 1996, Mr. Museveni basically turned a page. He became something different. He basically began to become what they call a strongman. So he has been systematically introducing the military into every aspect of Ugandan life, including civilian life. And he has also, on the other side, brought civilians under the jurisdiction of military courts. Our problem is that this has been used, it has been weaponized against political dissidents. So if you are a political opponent, then they will find a way of getting you under the military courts. And then you know your fate is sealed because they are not independent. They're not impartial. They are not competent because they're not lawyers. They'll do anything the president wants. Now, that is where the problem has always been.
What were the cases that were taken to the civilian courts?
Now, civilians were basically under the mainstream judiciary. Everything was okay. We had our problems with the courts, but it was okay. You knew you would face a judge who is qualified to sit in adjudication. You knew this person is a trained lawyer, a trained judge. They are bound by legal ethics to do what is right, what is just, and what is fair. So civilians were under that line. But when it became increasingly difficult for the president and his government, the ruling National Resistance Movement government, to pin down political opponents in a free and fair trial, then they introduced the concept of trying civilians in military courts and saying these are people subject to military law because they have been found in possession of military wear or they have worked with militants or military officers to commit offenses against the state. All the cases that we can look back at have basically been about fabrication of evidence. They take it before the military courts, and once you're there, justice will never visit your door. People have been detained for years and years without trial just because the military is the military. You cannot tell them anything because they'll basically say, we are waiting for superior orders, or like they call it, orders from above. And that is how they operate.
So has there ever been a case where a civilian was tried in the military courts and won the case and got freed?
There's never been a case like that. I can tell you with authority. There's never been a case like that. What happens is the moment you are subjected to the military courts, then high voltage phone calls begin traversing the city or the country, depending on where they have put you. And then they'll wait for orders to say, what should we do with this person? So the orders are then dished down to the guys in the court martial and say, do this, grant him bail or don't grant him bail, or he can go home or whatever it is. But we have no record of a free and fair trial in the military courts. It always comes down to what orders have been sent from above. And that is why it has been so painful. And then the other thing is, if they're going to let you go, then they will tell you, you're going to confess that you actually did what we're accusing you of. Once you confess, then we shall see what to do with you. We might let you go, or we shall sentence you to time served. You're not going anywhere until you confess. Now, that has been military justice for you in Uganda.
So have there been scenarios where civilians that were not in possession of arms were tried in the military courts?
I can tell you with authority, because we go to the courts martial all the time. If you see a civilian in the military court, you know there is a story behind them. And usually it is always somebody from the political opposition. What they usually do is plant the evidence. That is, we have a consistent chain of events that point to one, just one thing. They always plant the evidence, and their purpose is destroy or decimate the opposition. Anybody who opposes the government, they'll find a way to plant firearms or whatever it is in your car, and they'll get you into the courts martial, and then your goose is cooked.
So can you give me cases where scenarios of verdicts that you've seen in the past, you know, when your case is taken to the military court, what is mostly the verdict that we get to hear?
In the courts martial, basically, you're trying soldiers and sometimes civilians. Most of the time, really, they're soldiers. And we have seen a pattern of very unreasonable sentences. They give you 50 years. Why? You lost a firearm. You lost a firearm. I think we had one about 2 months ago. I forgot the name. This boy lost a firearm, and he was sentenced to about between 40 and 50 years for losing a firearm. Now, that is very, very painful. These are young people who can do a lot for the country, but one mistake or one purported mistake, we can't even be sure, because, again, the courts martial do not have the requisite competence to basically evaluate evidence and subject the facts of the case to the law as laid down in the statute books. So we have doubts about the competence and the propriety of the decisions, therefore, that come from the courts martial in the first place, because the people that make the decisions are not lawyers. These are just soldiers.
So what's the reaction in Uganda over this ruling?
Oh, people are very, very happy. People are very, very happy. It was like a liberation of sorts. People are really excited. Lawyers and ordinary people alike were in celebratory mood. And we're very, very happy because this is a shot in the arm for us as citizens of Uganda. We feel that one arm of oppression has been cut off. We shall have less problems to deal with, because the military courts have been a tool of repression against political dissent.
Tegule Gawaya, constitutional lawyer from Uganda. Botswana has long been synonymous with diamonds. De Beers, the mining giants, even more so. The two have had a long relationship through a joint venture called Debswana, a company through which the country and the company have been running the diamond industry in Botswana. By and large, it was seen as a well-run partnership that benefited the people of Botswana and the shareholders of De Beers. In 2023, Botswana and the Bears began discussing a deal to gradually increase Botswana's share of diamond production. That deal has now been sealed. Under the terms of the new agreement, Botswana government will be allowed to sell 30% of diamonds. The share rises to 50% in 2035. Let's hear from the Minister of Minerals and Energy, Buholo Kenewendo.
What we're very excited about, what is different this time around, is that due to the improvement in traceability technology, we will be ensuring that for the first time, Botswana diamonds are marketed as Botswana diamonds.
I mean, unemployment has been steadily rising in Botswana. It was a campaign issue in the run-up to the last elections. What sort of value or benefits can young people in Botswana anticipate in the coming days, possibly directly or indirectly as a result of this new deal?
The new deal will certainly contribute to the creation of jobs. But again, it's important that we recognize the challenges that are ongoing in the diamond industry at the moment, and that those structural changes will impact drastically the revenue that is generated to the government, but also the performance of the industry. Production around the world has significantly dropped, and therefore we have to brace ourselves for the challenges that are existing in this space.
What's your strategy to move Botswana beyond its reliance on diamond sales, with the threat of lab-grown diamonds and all the other challenges that you've raised around the sector?
Working on diversification away from diamonds. So within diamonds, working on beneficiation, but then focusing on other minerals that we have. And, you know, we just approved the expansion of two copper mines. We just awarded licenses for some of the rare metals. And we are excited about the opportunities that will come out of our critical materials strategy and critical materials in Botswana. And then we're also looking at the opportunities that exist in driving both renewables and power generation for the region.
All of this comes as, you know, talks continue in other parts of Africa, in the Sahel, in Tanzania as well, where we've seen renegotiating of various deals with multinational giants. Did this provide any inspiration or guidance for the kind of negotiations you are doing at this time?
We have benefited from the wealth of experience of our civil servants, and we've looked at everything else that's happening around the world and ensured that we can get the best deal possible.
Botswana Minister of Minerals and Energy, Buholo Kenewendo. Now, let's take a closer look at the detail of the deal with the political analyst, Marisa Lorenzo. First, her reaction to what the minister had said.
It's obviously a big relief for them to have gotten this deal signed. The diamond mining sector is really just underpins everything about Botswana's economy. And to have that kind of certainty going forward for the sector, for the economy, I think that the new administration really hopes to get economic growth on track, and the diamond mining sector is central to this.
But she didn't really talk much about the deal. So can you explain a bit more about what this new deal is between the Beers and Botswana?
So I think, you know, what is so interesting to me is that if we look at what the former administration led by President Masisi tried to get out of De Beers. He tried to get, you know, higher percentage of diamonds to be sold through Botswana, not only through De Beers, out of the Botswana agreement. And effectively, the agreement that Masisi put on the table and tried to force De Beers into is the one that has been agreed to by the new administration. But of course, with the new administration, you know, it's only been a few months in power, only since October. It looks very good on it to have said, you know, we've actually gotten this deal through. We've ended a lot of uncertainty for the diamond mining sector and for the economy. But yeah, really, it's not anything different to what we saw Masisi push for under the BDP. What will happen now is that the Botswana government has its own company, diamond sort of trading company called the Okavango Diamond Company, the ODC. It will now be able to increase its share to sell 30% of the rough diamonds that are produced by the four diamond mines in Botswana. And then De Beers will sell the remaining 70%, whereas before it was 75%. By 2035, the aim that both the government and De Beers have agreed to is for this to be increased to 50% to be sold through the ODC. The other part of the agreement is that De Beers has extended its mining licenses in Botswana to 2035, the option to renew for another 5 years.
So I would like to know what the positive side to this and also the negative side as well, you know, taking a closer look at the industry in Botswana and how this would affect the environment.
So I think the positive side of the deal with Botswana is that, you know, it shows the new administration has done, especially in signing this deal, is they've shown a willingness to actually create more certainty for the investment environment, which is obviously good for the diamond mining sector dominated by De Beers, but it's good for the sector as a whole. You know, so we heard the minister on the sound clip before speaking about they've invested in copper mines as well. The certainty that is introduced by this deal is good for sectors that go beyond diamond mining. But the negative side is, you know, just going back to the fact that Botswana is still very, it's not diversified. And when you have an economy that is so reliant on volatile commodities, they remain very vulnerable to external shocks. And this is not something that is going to change in the short or even the medium term. I think if we look to the end of the decade, Botswana is still going to be a mining economy that is primarily driven by diamonds. And when the diamond market is in flux, that spells bad news for the economy, and it means that the government has less money to put forward towards infrastructure, towards job creation, and things like that. So I think the Botswana that we see now, the problems that it's been facing over the last 5 years, I don't think that is materially going to change going forward.
So how are people reacting to this?
On the one hand, people welcome the certainty. I think that Masisi's populist rhetoric didn't sit well with all corners of Botswana society. Because when he mentioned that the trader Atrian Vap might come into the picture and might allow the ODC to sell more rough diamonds, people were very suspicious of that deal. So I think a lot of Botswana would have preferred that actually the deal with De Beers continues over the uncertainty that's introduced. There was also a lot of concerns about how are these deals being made with Atrian Vap, for example. But then you also get pockets of Botswana society that are, you know, very skeptical of the kind of hold that De Beers has over the government, and a kind of nervousness over the fact that it's one company that is very dominant, you know, over the Botswana economy. But I think overall there is a sense of relief, because with Masisi it wasn't clear which direction things were going and the economy was still suffering. Now there's much greater certainty and the economy is still struggling, but it's a way forward for maybe other investment to open up and more opportunities for the country.
The funds the government have received from their percentage, how have they been able to utilize it? And would this increase make any difference, you know, in people's lives?
It will make a difference if they can sell the 30% through the ODC. And like we mentioned before, that remains to be seen. Will it make a difference? It will depend on how it's utilized. Botswana, unfortunately, you know, it's got a very good reputation among African economies, but it's still struggles with massive issues of corruption. A lot of the time business will go to state-owned companies rather than private companies, and unfortunately that stifles job creation. So in terms of this deal kind of changing the situation on the ground for a lot of people, I don't think that will be the case, but certainly it will keep the diamond mining sector going in Botswana, and that does employ a lot of people.
Okay, so what would you say the factors that have helped Botswana to succeed in managing its mining sector?
Yeah, so I think in terms of success, what has been good is that, you know, when this agreement, this Botswana agreement, this joint venture between De Beers and the government of Botswana started out, what the Botswana government has done over the years is it has, you know, not been complacent. It has steadily increased the amount of rough diamonds that it is able to sell through the ODC. You know, so this has increased from 10% to 15% to 25%. And now to 30%. So it's been very good to not be complacent and not to say that, you know, De Beers can actually sell the majority of rough diamonds. It's been able to also get some control over that. What's also really worked in its favor is that it's a 50-50 joint venture, but De Beers actually puts upfront most of the capital that is required to run the mines. So that means that the government of Botswana has not had to put in as much capital, but can reap a lot of the benefits of the mining activities. And it's done very well to negotiate this. Obviously, De Beers has agreed to this because the mines are very profitable. So even though it has to put up a lot of capital, the money that it makes from selling these rough diamonds is something that also works out for them. But, you know, it works out for both parties. What the government of Botswana has also done now with the new agreement that's just been signed is the rough diamonds that are sold through De Beers will be marketed as diamonds from Botswana specifically, rather than just saying that they're diamonds under the De Beers. So this really puts Botswana on the map. And again, it positions it as a source of non-Russian diamonds, which can only work in its favor. What Botswana has not done so well, of course, is translating all of this revenue that it gets from its rough diamonds into better economic growth and better employment opportunities. So again, it's not one of the poorer economies in Africa, but it's got a very small population and it has not been able to drive activity into other sectors. So for example, all of the revenue that it gets from rough diamonds, it should have greater infrastructure development, but it shouldn't be struggling as much with aging water infrastructure. It shouldn't still be prone to blackouts. It should have developed its tech services sector. And it has not been translating these revenues from the diamond mining sector into greater, wider, more diversified economic growth, which is not a problem that is unique to Botswana at all. We see it in many other African economies that, you know, do have commodities like oil or minerals. And that's where I think Botswana has not done so well to translate the opportunities it has into wider growth.
Political analyst Marisa Lorenzo. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Let's talk sports, but not the kind of sport we usually talk about. This is a game that is played in northern Nigeria, and people have been pitting their strength against each other for generations by playing Langa. It's also known as the hopping game, and in it, opponents show off their agility, endurance, and strategic maneuvers, all of it on one leg. It requires speed, balance, and resilience, and you have to be strong. The game is deeply rooted in the Hausa Fulani culture of northern Nigeria. Khalid Hussein is the chairman of the Social Langa Club. He's been explaining why this game is important in Hausa society.
In Hausa land, when you wanted to identify the strongest and the brave children within the community or the society, you identify the strongest and the brave men through such type of games. That is the traditional way of identifying the strongest people within the society so that they can join war or any other thing similar to that one.
The structured form of the sport, combined with its unique test of the physicality of the players, makes Langa compelling for competitors and spectators alike. It has been featured at national events in Nigeria, and the hope is that the discipline can spread further from its West African heartland.
From our schools, the students used to play this traditional game. It was introduced into the Nigerian Sport Festival in 1996. What we are now seeking for is to see that Langa has been introduced or incorporated in our West African games so that from there it can move to European games.
Let's hear more about this intriguing sport from our BBC Sports colleague, Emmanuel Akindubua, who went to film one of the games.
Emmanuel, to be honest with you, I've always hopped on one leg, but it's either I'm being punished or I'm just playing a random game, you know, that game they call Suwe in Nigeria. So what exactly is Langa?
Okay, Langa is a popular traditional sport amongst the Hausa Fulani ethnic group of northern Nigeria. It is played with each player on one leg competing against one another. It's quite tedious from the outside, but when you begin to watch how they play it, you find it's quite intriguing and interesting as well. When I was making my research about this piece, I was wondering how much of an excitement would you get by hopping on one leg across a surface? But to be honest with you, watching the Langa match, it's as interesting as watching a Champions League game because there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of intensity, there's a lot of passion and resilience that you see from these players, and it's a very interesting sport. I mean, played traditionally in northern Nigeria, but it's now spread into parts of West Africa.
I would like you to paint a picture because when you say hopping on one leg, I can just hop on one leg. So am I doing the game? What is it like? I need you to paint a picture of what I'm going to see. And then I would say this is Langa.
Langa is played with some certain rules. Even as you hop on one leg, you need to clasp your feet to your hand behind you. You're not hopping sideways. It has to be behind you. So all that you're seeing is one leg. That helps you maintain some level of balance even as you hop along. And that also gives you some opportunity to lean back on your other leg, which is off the ground a bit in case you're being tossed around by your opponent. There's a squared demarcation for this game, like a form of a court that you play with two teams on both sides, each team with at least 3 or 6 players, depending on the number of players that are available. And for each of the team, there is a target that is identified with headband. The target is called the Rua. The Rua is what you could call the golden chase or the golden player, that if you could get hold of him, you get the points. So both sides would want to defend their Rua, as the Rua would hope to get across safely to the other side of the opponent's half. That's the idea behind the race. And they do this hopping on one leg throughout the whole contest. So it's quite intense. There's a lot of blood. There's a lot of falling. There's a lot of dust. There's a lot of excitement that comes with the sport, because at the end of the day, it shows that the strength, the energy level of both sides will be tested within the period when the game is ongoing.
When you said blood, I'm like, wow, that's really competitive. So how far does the history of Langa go? And how has it evolved over the years?
Now, that goes back to many centuries in the Hausa Fulani culture. Historically, it as a sport that was used to train warriors, according to the history of the Hausa Fulani people. It's a warrior's training sport to identify those who are strong, those who could survive, and who could maneuver their way in any situation. But over time, the sport has now become a part of the culture where, at festivals, at school events, young boys are encouraged to take part in the sport. The involvement means it's become more structured. In 1996, it was adopted into the Nigerian Sports Festival, spreading the popularity of the sport to other parts of the country that were not traditionally used to the sport. From the research, we gathered teams like Rivers State, Bayelsa in the southern part of Nigeria have embraced Langa so well that they even employ coaches from northern Nigeria to train their athletes about the sport.
Girls, women, do they play this game?
Traditionally, the Hausa Fulani people do not ordinarily expose their women, I hope I'm safe to say this, to all sorts of physicality. They consider the women to be very delicate and they let them take care of the home front. So there are no history that women have taken part in Langa. But of course, as the game gets expanded and get embraced by other parts of the country or other parts of the world, there are possibilities that women may want to try out the sport owing to its physical advantage as well.
Describe what the atmosphere is like. Are women allowed to watch this game? You know, if they can participate for now, and how many minutes would the game last for?
Women are allowed to watch, and I must say a lot of women were also on ground to watch the matches that we recorded in the course of gathering for this piece. But one concern that they put in place is that they do not allow the women to get so close to the arena, so they do not get affected by the pushing and all sorts of that. Then talking about the second part of your question, Langa is played in rounds. It's not time-bound. It's what you could call maybe the best of 5 rounds. And this is one of the reasons why the sport has endured generations and centuries after it was introduced as traditionally a means of training warriors in the Fulani ethnic group.
You said it can get bloody. How safe is it? And in terms of safety measures, would they be safety measures moving forward as the modernized one, if maybe not the traditional one?
With every traditional sport, it comes in its raw form. But of course, as it gets more popular, there will be some modifications that will be expected. But from what we gathered, there are safety measures. Though you have to compete with your bare foot, you're allowed to wear clothes around your knees to protect your knees from bleeding or getting peeled off when you fall around. And of course, you are encouraged to be in good state of health before you can compete. So those are the basic safety measures put in place.
Do you see this game thriving, not just in Nigeria, but outside the country?
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of prospect around the sport traveling further across the world beyond the West African heartland where it originated from. I think the sport has a lot of excitement that most kind of physical sports offers. Imagine you hopping on one leg for about 30 minutes or about 15 minutes. It does a whole lot of benefits to your blood flow.
When you went there, you know, to cover the story, did you try doing the Langa game?
Absolutely. I had a shot at it alongside with my colleague. We're filming together. we had to do a
push. And how long would you hop on one leg?
I was very cautious not to assume I could compete against the professional guys. So I had my shoes on and I did that for about 2 or 3 minutes and I gassed out, sadly. So it's a very intense sport. You can't switch your leg in the middle of play. Once you've decided you're using any of your legs to hop around during the contest, you have to stick to that. And if you place your second foot on the ground, you get immediately disqualified. If you notice you're having a cramp around your legs and you wish to use the other leg at the start of another round, you're allowed to do that as long as you're willing to compete.
I can bet you that when I see you, I would hop on one leg and I'll beat you to your time.
Absolutely. That would be nice. perhaps you would be the one leading the female inclusion in the Langa Hill as well.
I know, right? Yes.
BBC sports journalist Emmanuel Akindubua. Focus on Africa was put together by Yvette Togira Maria and Bella Hassan in London. Carney Sharp was a senior producer in charge. Francesca Dunn, the technical producer, Andre Lombard and Alice Muthengi are editors. I'm Blessing Adiroba. Thanks for listening.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking, and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually. And it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on. And take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.